Intelligent design and DNA. Scholars can't explain it all away. Get ready to be awed by the handiwork of God. Tune in to Real Science Radio. Turn up the Real Science Radio.
Greetings to the brightest audience in the country. Welcome to another episode of Real Science Radio. I'm Fred Williams, creation speaker and software engineer. There is a tremendous article in the latest Creation Research Society Quarterly, the spring 2013 issue. As some of you may know, I'm the webmaster for Creation Research Society, so I'm privy to some of these articles before they actually hit the press. And there's an article in this spring edition titled Dobzhansky, 40 Years Later, Nothing Makes Sense. Now, I remember this guy because he's famous for saying, nothing in biology makes sense except in the light of evolution. I don't know how many times I've heard that over the years. Well, this was a great article. I read through it and it's like, okay, I got to interview the author of this article. And we're going to do that today. So welcome to the show, Mr. Bob Inyart.
Hey, Fred Williams. It's an honor to be on Real Science Radio. Thanks for inviting me.
Yeah, it's great to have you here, Bob.
Fred, this is fun. I have had published about 100 articles in newspapers and magazines. This is my first in a peer-reviewed scientific journal. This is a creation journal. It's the Creation Research Society Quarterly. And what a process it was to go from the first draft through all these scientists who are the reviewers.
Yeah, and this magazine has been around for 50 years. In fact, they're celebrating their 50-year anniversary. Mm. And it's really, in my opinion, the most prestigious of all the creation technical scientific mm-hmm. journals. And wow, what a great article, Bob. I'm serious. I know that I'm biased, but
yeah, we're friends, so I can't trust your claim here, Fred.
This really is a tremendous article.
So, but thank you for your kind words. And Fred, when I submitted this draft, I didn't know, you know, I'm not a scientist, but you don't have to be a scientist to be published in a scientific journal, but you have to pass peer review.
Yes.
And so it turns out this is about evolution. So there was a biologist, a molecular biology professor, other scientists who went through the review process, and it was daunting, I'll tell you that. It was rigorous. And the end result, I'm so thrilled with this paper about Theodosius Dobzhansky, this famous evolutionist.
And this hit the presses at about the 40-year anniversary of him making that quote, right?
That's
again, part of your title, Dobzhansky, 40 Years Later, Nothing Makes Sense.
Right. So he had made predictions in what I think is the most famous evolution article ever published.
Yes.
Because the title of his article has been repeated thousands of times, and it's the quote you started the show with, nothing in biology makes sense except in the light of evolution. That's some claim.
Yeah, that was the big quote taken from that article, and it repeated so many times.
Yes, and he published this in March of 1973. So here we are, spring edition, 2013, 40 years have passed, and it turns out, Fred, that he made three predictions in his paper, and all three have been falsified.
All three have been falsified. And so your paper goes through each of those predictions,
yes,
and it's a point-by-point presentation of his entire article and his claims. And it's really interesting, the things that he said.
Yeah. For example, Fred, his three predictions, the first, that genetics would confirm Darwin's tree of life, that hierarchical tree. Secondly, that the life sciences, their discoveries would center on evolution work. That would be the center of all upcoming discoveries.
Yeah. And his third was kind of silly, huh?
Third, of all things, he predicted that one particular Arab sheikh, would always believe that the sun orbited the earth.
Yeah.
That's his third prediction.
This guy's name was Abd el Aziz bin Baz.
Yeah. That's something.
So that was his third prediction.
Did you know him?
I did not know him.
You said that name well. Sheikh Abd el Aziz bin Baz, he was insisting, even recently in the 70s, that the sun orbited the earth. Dobzhansky has a lengthy introduction to his paper. His paper is 4 pages. Lengthy introduction. It deals neither with evolution nor biology. It makes guilt by association charges against creationists. It talks about the laws of planetary motion. That's an interesting topic. I'm all for it.
Yeah.
Doesn't have to do with biology, but I like it. And he makes an invalid appeal to authority. And so I go through his intro and piece by piece attempt to show this. So his logical fallacy to begin with is this assumption that because the methods of applied science, which, you know, creationists and evolutionists, we all agree on applied science.
Yes.
Because applied science works, like men could go to the moon, therefore he indicates that evolutionists should be trusted in a totally different field, and namely that their theories on biological origins should be accepted.
Wow.
Well, that's a non sequitur.
Yeah,
because we can go to the moon, therefore you need to believe Charles Darwin. Well, what invention did Charles Darwin come up with? So applied science, it's so amazing that it survives enormous changes in all these secular theories on origins. Like, Fred, you probably came to the studio today driving in a vehicle. When the evolutionists changed their...
I actually came on a horse today, Bob.
You did?
Just
okay,
kidding.
Then I retract my observation. When they changed their theories of origins, does your car stop working? Do airplanes fall out of the sky? Do telephone calls no longer could be connected? What? Because atheists now propose millions of parallel universes or aliens seeding life on Earth? None of their changes in their beliefs and origins affect any of our technologies or inventions.
And this is how his article begins.
Begins implying that, well, because applied sciences works, therefore we're right on our atheistic origins claims.
Oh, man.
That's a non sequitur.
Mm-hmm.
That is an invalid appeal to authority. It's an official logical fallacy. So that's the start. So then, Fred, in this paper, I mention how Darwin's book has an overreaching title on the origin of species, because he doesn't really tell you how the first species began, does he?
Mm-hmm. No.
He begins with species.
Yeah, that's right.
So if you're going to talk about on the origin of species, it'd be nice to explain how the first ones began, but he doesn't. And even the evolution of stars, you and I have talked about this, when they present the standard models for the evolution of stars, they begin with what? The explosion of pre-existing stars.
And we said, so it sounds like a chicken and egg thing.
Exactly. It's like, that's cheating, guys. You can't start with stars when you want to explain the evolution of stars. Or they start with protostars, you know, stars already forming. The public has this high level of confidence in secular origins, but it's not justified. In fact, the fundamental nature of matter, you know, what is matter? What is life? What are the physical laws? What is space? All of that is still a deep mystery. So surely the matter of how all that originated has to be even more mysterious and inscrutable to secular science if we don't understand what these things are. So I think Dobzhansky begins with this logical fallacy that's easy to spot.
Easy to spot. And then he jumps right into his first prediction, which is actually about the Arab Sheik.
Yeah.
And he says, he's basically saying it's useless to present evidence to people like this because they'll just never believe it.
Yes.
So that's his prediction. And he's, in a way, he's taking a slam indirectly at
creationists.
Yeah, creationists.
Yeah, he's trying to use this guilt by association. And so he says, those who fear enlightenment, no amount of evidence would ever impress them. And he mentions this poor slob of a sheik, Bin Baz. And he says, no evidence would ever impress him. And so it turns out that Dobzhansky was wrong on that. Yeah.
Yeah. So even that easy prediction he's wrong on. So, Bob, what's interesting is this guy actually did change his mind in 1985 based on the evidence. And, you know, I didn't know that until I read your article. So the United States invited this prince to fly aboard the space shuttle Discovery. Mm-hmm. And later he heard his firsthand account from his friend.
So the Sheik Bin Baz.
Bin Baz.
Had a friend who flew in the space shuttle. That's amazing, Fred.
Yeah. And so he basically believed his account, changed his mind, and Dobzhansky was
strike one.
Yeah, strike one.
Strike one.
So strike one out of the three predictions.
Right. Dobzhansky was correct when he said the Sheik was ignorant of the evidence. But he was incorrect when he said no amount of evidence would convince this guy. Mm-hmm. So first prediction failed. You know, Dobzhansky is talking about science literacy. And that's an interesting topic because it turns out that science literacy is not a good predictor of the American public's acceptance of these politically correct science claims, like global warming or humans evolving from primates. There was a study funded by the National Science Foundation, and Fred, it was reported in the journal Nature Climate Change. Mm-hmm. So this is what, the motherlode of global warming stuff. And what they reported was this: as science literacy increased, concern with climate change decreased.
So the smarter they are, the more they know about the climate and science and whatnot, the less they believed in this silly theory of global warming.
Man-made global warming. Exactly. Fred, I think that the National Science Foundation is not going to fund a similar study regarding evolution because they would be discouraged, right? Because it turns out that people who are educated in science tend to shy away from evolution.
Yeah. And you've got great points in this to follow that up with, for example, 60% of U.S. public school biology teachers would rather not teach evolution. You know, there's a lot of reasons I don't blame them. Most of all, of course, because the science just doesn't support it. The evidence isn't there.
Right.
And then I think we're growing as a movement, the creationists. Oh. They're getting more and more questions from students that they just can't refute because they're so solid, so common sense.
Yes.
And
like, wouldn't you have bad legs long before you got good wings?
Yeah.
Like, if something is evolving into a bat or whatever, and wouldn't you first have really bad legs?
Yeah.
And then survival of the fittest, the whole species would be dead.
And what about U.S. medical doctors? Are they?
Oh, hundreds of thousands of them.
Yes.
According to a major study. And these are by evolutionary institutions, these studies, 60% reject this strict secular Darwinism, and they say God was involved in the origin of human life.
Yeah, and Dobzhansky, who you wrote about, he came up with neo-Darwinism, you know, the buzzword of the current modern theory of evolution.
He's the father of neo-Darwinism.
And what is that? That's natural selection working with random mistakes in the DNA. We're talking
mutations.
Mutations are mistakes.
Right. So, yeah, neo-Darwinism is you marry Darwin and DNA. So Darwin, meet DNA. DNA, meet Darwin. So you take Darwinism and genetics and you merge them. So Theodosius Dobzhansky, he had associates who did this also, but ultimately he's the father of neo-Darwinism. You know, the most famous evolutionist, if you look at the ones historically, it's got to be something like Darwin, Dobzhansky, and Dawkins. That's the lineup.
That's three D's in science. Speaking of D's in science, you know, his next thing, he presents contradictory conclusions when he defends an old universe. What's that all about?
Okay, so his old universe, Dobzhansky believes, like, you know, evolutionists all do, that the universe has been around for a long, long time, but he gives a range of how long it's been around, and that range is pretty interesting when you think about it. What he's actually saying, the range, it's very telling.
It is very telling. I mean, he says that the universe may have existed eternally.
That's a long time.
That's a very long time. And then he turns around and says, well, it may have existed for 10 billion years.
Huh?
So when I look at that timeline, Bob, I see 10, you know, billion years to 10 to the infinity power. That's a big range.
That's big.
That's huge.
So evolutionist and secular minded scientists, they seem to be comfortable with near infinite elasticity in interpreting data. In this case, you go from 10 to the ninth to 10 to the infinite, right? Now that dwarfs the comparatively modest disagreement they have with us, because as creationists, we believe that the Earth is less than 10,000 years old. So the disagreement we have with Big Bang advocates is it's 10 to the fourth to 10 to the ninth. That's relatively modest.
Yeah, comparatively
speaking. 10 to the fourth to 10 to the ninth.
And you know, Bob, evolutionists, they love big numbers because I think it just snows over the public, the people who aren't paying attention, because it's so abstract. It's just, you know,
people can't follow it. Right?
Yeah, they really. And
it's hard.
The
it's
guy
hard
sounds
for anyone.
Smart, so he must be right, you know.
Yeah.
And then it's interesting. It's not the only big number they refer to. We've talked about it on the show recently, how secular scientists have proposed all these millions and millions of parallel universes. In fact, 10 to the 500 power parallel universes. Where did they come up with these numbers?
10?
Are they watching too many Star Trek episodes?
Yeah, I guess so. 10. And, you know, they have their reasons in string theory and all, but they want 10 to the 500 parallel universes because ours is so wildly unlikely. It's so wildly perfectly fine-tuned for life that, and it's pointed out to them by many, that, well, how could all these variables, how could they all be perfect? How is it? And so they said, well, you know, since there's trillions and trillions of universes, obviously you'd get one that was good for life. So it turns out that, you know, Dobzhansky failed to see that by pursuing strictly naturalistic assumptions, that that would lead these anti-creationists to make wildly elastic, over-the-top interpretations from the data to say, like, aliens seeded life on Earth, and there must be trillions of universes. So when cosmologists today, they look at biomolecules mm-hmm. and how complex they are. I mean, you know, lipids, proteins, DNA, wildly complex. And think about how it all started in the first place, like the initial reproduction. And so from all of that, they think, okay, how do you get there if you have non-directed natural processes?
So they cook up this 10 to the 500 power universes. You know, this 10 to the 500 power, too, people don't need to understand how big a number this is. Mm-hmm. Now, correct me if I'm wrong, but I'm pretty sure that scientists estimate that there's 10 to the 80th power atoms in the universe.
Yeah, that's the ballpark, right?
Yeah, so think of a
pebble in the whole universe.
In the whole universe. So think of a pebble of sand on the beach. That probably has billions of atoms in it. And so 10 to the 80th power is a total number of atoms in the entire universe. And they're saying, oh, there's 10 to the 500 power universes.
Where's Carl Sagan when you need him?
billions and billions
of atoms in a single grain of sand. And so that means if 10 to the 80th indicates how many atoms are in the universe, 10 to the 81st would be 10 universes.
Yes.
10 to the 83rd would be 1,000. 10 to the 86th would be 1,000,000 universes.
And we're going up to 10 to 500.
10 to the
power 500. Of 500.
Yeah, it's just so wild.
It is wild. And Bob, this is my favorite quote in the entire article. I loved it when I read this.
Ooh,
this
is
so cool.
Thank you. Wow.
And this is, I'm quoting Mr. Bob Inyart of Real Science Radio. In this article, great line, septillions upon septillions of universes are merely spoken into existence by the very persons who deny that God has the ability to speak into existence one universe.
Wow.
What a great quote, Bob.
Well, thank you very much, Fred. It is so fun to sit back and think about what are these atheists really saying. Now, Dobzhansky claimed to be a Christian, but he didn't believe in life after death. He's not a Christian. He's a fraud. He's a functional atheist for sure. It turns out, Fred, that they're claiming, you know, we have all the scientific evidence that the Earth is billions of years old. But as we've covered on this program, Real Science Radio, short-lived carbon-14 is everywhere it's not supposed to be, including in the interior of diamonds. That's fun.
That is.
So when Dobzhansky says the origin of life on Earth is dated tentatively between 3 and 5 billion years ago, it's quite a wide range.
That is, actually.
And, you know, that wide range might clue people in to wonder, is that a scientific statement or a philosophical statement? Mm-hmm. Because he just doesn't want to believe that God created, so he has near infinite flexibility in his interpretation of data. I point out here at this point that our sun has about 10 billion years worth of fuel.
10 billion years. Okay.
God is amazing. Now, astronomers have danced awkwardly trying not to step on evolutionist toes mm-hmm. for the last 40 years because Dobzhansky in 1973 ignored that young sun problem. We've done this on the
Carl
show.
Carl Sagan.
The faint young sun problem. Right, Carl Sagan.
Yeah, in 1972, he published that.
He did, and he pointed out, in fact, physics calculations show that the sun would have been 30% cooler. Now, think about that. You know, on a warm, sunny day, imagine if there's 30% less energy coming to the Earth on a warm, sunny day, it might be chilly.
And as it turns out, I mean, you point out, what effect does it have on water and oceans?
Well, the oceans, we would not have liquid oceans if a few billion years ago, if the sun was 30% cooler. And that contradicts the evolutionary stories from geologists, paleontologists, and so on. None of those scientists, oceanographers, none of them report any evidence that the oceans were ever iced over on a frozen Earth.
Yeah, which would be the case if this sun is really billions of years old.
Yeah. So billions of years ago, the sun would be cold comparatively. And so, Fred, what happens to sunlight if it's traveling here? It takes 8.5 minutes to get here.
Okay.
And it hits the Earth and the Earth is frozen. What happens?
Well, it reflects back into space much more effectively than, say, rocks or vegetables or Al Gore.
Or Al Gore. Yeah, vegetation, liquid water, they absorb the sun's energy. But because ice deflects the heat required to thaw the ice, then the Earth would still be frozen today. So this is a big problem that Dobzhansky ignored, like he ignored many other problems. So again, this is called the faint young sun problem. The technique that evolutionists use to deal with this faint young sun problem, they propose this automatic fine-tuning. It really cracks me up, Fred. It started in 1972 with Carl Sagan when he said, well, the oceans then must have had a lot of ammonia.
A lot of ammonia.
It's like your radiator in your car, you know, you put stuff in it so it doesn't freeze, antifreeze.
Yeah.
Then that failed because there is no evidence that it had all that ammonia to keep it from freezing in the past. So now what they do today is they propose this fine-tuning secondary assumption where they say, well, the greenhouse gases in the atmosphere matched, correspondingly matched, the change in the temperature of the sun. Or the solar mass correspondingly changed to the, you know, the just-so relationship of energy output, solar wind, atmospheric conditions, cosmic rays. It all just fine-tuned itself for billions of years. It's another appeal to this anthropic, well, it must have happened because it happened.
Yeah, and just wild hand waving. And then, you know, one of the ones that's a little bit more challenging, Bob, let's talk about the radiometric dating.
Oh, yeah, because he put his faith in the estimates of radiometric evidence. And Fred, that evidence and the interpretation of it is based on selective data. And even back then and still today, it shows great inconsistencies. And I give a list of some of these because creationists have been widely publicizing the anomalies, the results that the evolutionists leave on the floor of the laboratory.
That's right. So, for example, you mentioned that new rock can date 1 million years old.
Wow, just out of a volcano,
new,
right?
Right out of a volcano, a brand new rock.
How old is that rock?
This happens all the time, right? How do they explain those away?
It's 1 million years old. Yeah. Actually, it formed in 1980 at Mount St. Helens. Well, we potassium argoned it. Looks like it's 1 million years old. So they, the
so
way
they blame it on contamination, right? Or excess argon is, you know.
It shouldn't be.
Yeah.
It shouldn't be. If it's brand new and it's 1 million years old, that's an indication that something might not be right with the dating method.
Yeah. And so if we can't date rocks where we know the age, why are we expected to trust the dates of rocks where we don't know the age? And then I like this one. The same rock flow in the Grand Canyon's inner gorge gives contradictory dates that are 1.5 days apart.
1.5 days apart?
Oh, actually, it says 1.5 billion years apart.
Billion.
So we're talking about the same rock flow. So how does the same rock flow, you date it at different parts of the rock flow, and it gives dates that are 1.5 billion years apart, and the public is expected to trust all these radiometric dates.
Yes.
Again, how can you trust these dates when we can't even trust the, you know, these kind of dates? It's amazing. And then you look at the rocks on top of the Grand Canyon, and, well, this is strange. They're older than the rocks in the bottom of the canyon. So some weird reversal happened there,
These are really fun things. Also, I make a reference here to Dr. Walt Brown and his Origin of Earth's Radioactivity paper, where he reports that radioisotope half-lives. Now, that's a mouthful. Well, a half-life of something like DNA, we reported recently where the half-life of DNA is about 500 years.
So that means after 500 years, half the DNA will be gone.
It'll be, you can't even realize that it's DNA.
Yeah.
It's just acids. And so the radioisotope half-lives are inconsistent. So they're not the absolute clock-like feature that people used to think they were. Also, laboratories measure significant levels of carbon-14, which only lasts thousands of years, but they find it in diamonds, which is supposed, they're supposed to be a billion years old. And they find it in natural gas, marble, coal, even in dinosaur fossils.
Well, C-14 has always been a great argument for creationists. It's amazing how many evolutionists think that C-14, you know, supports an old Earth. And it actually is the exact opposite.
Yeah, that's what, how many people have called this show and they said, well, you know, carbon-14 proves the Earth is billions of years old. And we got it. It's like we're in, you know, general science 101 or something. Like, okay, here we go again. So, Fred, this paper on Theodosius Dobzhansky, 40 years later, nothing makes sense. It's really fun going through this. I enjoy it. I enjoy this topic. And so many atheists and evolutionists think that Dobzhansky slaughtered creationists with his brilliant arguments.
Yeah.
So could we continue this? Because
yeah, we should. This is great,
we're
Bob.
Still in his intro where he's made not even a single valid claim.
That's right. And what's great about this article is it just covers so much of the material. We've talked a lot about a lot of this stuff over the years on Real Science Radio. But what a great way that all of this is in this article. It covers a lot of different topics on creation and evolution.
Yeah,
and
it's just like fabulous. An overview, right?
And it's very good job on all the references that you've provided. It's very well
Thank
researched.
Thank you, Fred. I haven't counted them. About 100 references, mostly to peer-reviewed journal papers.
And it's not easy to get an article accepted in the Creation Research Society quarterly. So it has to be well done. It has to be well researched. So again, congratulations.
Well,
I was so excited when I saw it before I published it on the web.
Yeah, thanks for doing that.
Bob, what's this article?
So, in fact, if someone would like to read this, they could go to crsq.org, right?
That's right. And right now, you have to be a member. You have to get in the premium area. And I'm hoping that they select this as the public article.
Okay. But also, people could subscribe. They could become a member.
Absolutely.
Or subscribe, and then they could read this.
Yes, please do. Thanks, everybody, for tuning in to Real Science Radio. And Bob, thanks for being my guest today.
You're very welcome, Fred. What an honor.
And I'd love to have you back next week to finish this article.
Let's do it. Sounds fun. God bless you guys. RealScienceRadio.com.
Real Science Radio.
Hi, this is Bob Enyart. At Real Science Radio, we have a great science store online, realscienceradio.com. Click on the store, and there are two fabulous DVDs, What You Aren't Being Told About Astronomy, Volume 1 and Volume 2. These are by a dear friend of Real Science Radio, Spike Pisaris, and Spike has created simply the greatest astronomy DVDs ever produced. And we have gone through probably hundreds of science DVDs and books, and we recommend only the very best at our store, realscienceradio.com. Click on the store, and you'll love these astronomy DVDs, What You Aren't Being Told About Astronomy, Volume 1 and Volume 2. You got to get them.